Welcome to session two of the PDH online course on the 2008 National Electric Code. We're going to go into the core material of the National Electric Code in the same order as it's presented in the book. I will try to mention citations, so if you choose to follow along in the book, you can look at the same section I'm looking at. Or if you hear something that sounds really strange to you, you can jot down the section and come back to it when you have a little time to look at it. The preface: the 1896 National Electric Code was created to reduce insurance losses from fires of electrical origin. Now, this is not too surprising when you think about it. We are the National Fire Protection Association. It was formed by insurance companies to reduce fires. And I find it very interesting the way it's expanded today to what the National Electric Code has become. Now, the preface and introduction are non-enforceable, meaning the inspector can't point at this and saying you're violating this section. In the preface and Article 90, they are non-enforceable, but it's very, very good information to tell you where the National Electric Code is coming from and how their thinking works. Because a lot of times when you're confused about something, it's not you're trying to avoid following the regulation, you're trying to figure out what in the world the regulation is. And having a little concept of how they think helps you figure out what they're probably looking for. Article 90, the introduction, as we say again, non-enforceable. The introduction is non-enforceable. Hey, this guy thinks the same way I do. That means that a plans reviewer or inspector is in error if he cites you for non-compliance in Article 90. The fine print notes in various sections are also non-enforceable, as are references. Often the National Electric Code references other NFPA publications. This information is offered as an aid to understanding the section, but the portion or document referenced is not enforceable as part of the NEC. The introduction mentions a goal of the NEC is to harmonize with European electrical standards, the IEC publications. IEC is International Electrotechnical Commission. This is good for U.S. manufacturers and designers doing business around the world. In addition, it forced the NFPA to address issues that were not interesting to U.S. manufacturers and installers who make up the committee on the code. Tightened down a lot of things that NFPA was willing to let slide. They have a safety importance recognized from a foreign viewpoint. If we're going to be compatible with a foreign viewpoint, we have to adopt at least a little bit of what they're talking about. And in my opinion, this has been good. For example, IEC has a very different idea about electric safety and explosion-proof installations. The ideas have slowly become part of the NEC and are responsible for several of the significant changes in the current edition. Section 90 lists areas covered and excluded by the NEC. Beyond being in a non-enforceable section of the code, this list gives a directionally incorrect concept. The NEC is enforced wherever someone in charge chooses to enforce it. The book doesn't decide where it's enforced. The book just lays there. The guy who's pounding his fist on the table is the one who enforces it. Railroads are specifically excluded, but railroad operating companies can choose to enforce the National Electric Code internally as an aid to avoiding liability in lawsuits, since the judge will look at the NEC as a recognized standard of safe installation. Further, the NEC is being revised more broadly each year outside NFPA and within NFPA committees. For instance, NFPA embraced communication and data wiring several editions ago. This means that plans reviewers can demand details about communications and data equipment and planned wiring, and they can hold up the project until they get it. Similarly, as inspectors become more sophisticated, they will be closely examining details of communications and data installation. This is a massive change. Communications and data installers come from a different tradition than commercial and industrial electricians, and in the past, they've paid no attention to fire safety and grounding rules. The question of covered by the NEC or not covered frequently comes up in defining service point. When you buy electricity from a utility, at some point the responsibility for installation and maintenance shifts from the seller to the buyer. The NEC has vaguely stated opinions. The matter is decided by state and local regulations and by utility policies. It's common for the utility to specify overhead wiring from the street or wiring an underground conduit and the meter base, but the owner's contractor must install it, subject to utility inspection. The utility does the final hot tie-in. The message here that questions regarding service points should be discussed with the utility and the results documented and saved. Experience indicates that different areas within a single utility in a single city will have different area supervisors and different enforcement of the rules. Article 100, definitions. Sometimes we skip over definitions because we're familiar with the terms used in the field. This is especially an error with the National Electric Code. The code writers have the habit of changing the rules by redefining or adding a term. For example, there is a critical distinction among accessible, readily accessible for equipment, and readily accessible for wiring. Accessible means not guarded by locked doors or elevation. The concept is that a user should be able to get at a disconnect switch when a piece of equipment starts smoking. If the only switch or circuit breaker is in a locked closet, there is a problem. As you would guess, however, most owners of public buildings don't want the general public turning off the lights or equipment, and they lock it in the electric room. This produces a conflict, which is satisfied by the normal practice not documented in the code and varying from location to location. It's almost universal to lock the electric room, and the code references this in some places. On the other hand, ASHRAE 90.1, enforced in all 50 states, requires individual light switches in each area of use. In commercial occupancies, almost all equipment has a wall plug and can be used for emergency disconnect. In industrial occupancies, almost all equipment has a nearby safety disconnect switch. Is accessible provided if you need a ladder to get at the device? Yes, that's the difference between accessible and readily accessible. For wiring, accessible means you don't have to damage the building to get at the connection. This is the reason for access panels, junction boxes, and surface-mounted and recessed-mounted equipment. Fully concealed equipment must have some available screws to get at the innards. This comes up in renovations when a panel board is replaced. The old panel box with connections for extension must be left accessible. It is not permissible to make wiring extensions then mount the new panel on top of the old panel. Old empty box. 2008 changes to Article 100 definitions include equipment, which now includes machinery. The NEC is sticking its nose inside control cabinets in enforcing protection and short circuit withstand. This is still part of the voluntary NFPA 79 industrial machinery, but it's now mandatory with an enforcement agency. Definitions of grounding conductors have been revised, but are still confusing. Equipment grounding conductor means the green wire from the panel to the equipment. Grounding electrode conductor means the number 6 AWG, usually, wire from the service panel to the ground rod. The wiring has expanded substantially in the 2008 code, which we'll get into later. Qualified person has been revised to require more training and documentation of training for persons working on electrical equipment. This is critical, but very vague as regards arc flash permissible approach limit. The later arc flash section limits permissible locations for persons who do not have documented training in working with exposed electrical conductors, and this refers to operators, supervisors, salesmen, and contractors. The definition for authority having jurisdiction, AHJ, has not changed and isn't confusing to persons in the electrical trade. It is, however, sometimes confusing to building owners and plant managers. On most commercial and industrial projects, the construction documents must be submitted to a city or county building standards department for approval before a building permit can be issued. The plans reviewer at the building standards department and his electrical inspector are the authority having jurisdiction. These persons can make demands for changes in the equipment and materials used and the methods used to install them. The stick they wave is the building permit and the certificate of occupancy. Sometimes a state official or military base commander has this responsibility. In very, very rare cases, the building owner or plant manager has the responsibility. The code refers to insurance inspectors having AHJ responsibility, but this course disputes that, thinking rather that an insurance inspector is part of a contractual relationship with the owner and the constructor, and it's not a legal relationship in the same way that the National Electric Code and AHJ are. Your author is presently suffering significant pain dealing with a manufacturing facility that doesn't want to put lights and receptacles on the roof at HVAC equipment. don't want to put ground fault protection on their 2000 amp 480Y277V switchboard. When a professional engineer places his seal on a set of construction documents, he is certifying that it complies with the applicable codes and includes provisions to safeguard the public. The requirement for lights and receptacles at rooftop HVAC equipment comes from the building code, not the NEC, but the ground fault protection comes from Section 215.10 of the NEC, which we'll get into later. The term bonding has been slightly revised and is now well explained in the NEC handbook, which is a non-enforceable document published by the people who put together the National Electric Code. Bonding means connection of something to ground. Something that was not connected to ground previously, or something that may have been poorly connected to ground. The purpose is to provide a good path for ground for fault current, to trip over current protection, or to trip ground fault protection. The information technology people, that's IT, are very prominent in facility design and installation these days, and many do not understand requirements for grounding and bonding. The new RCDD, Registered Computer Data Designer, training is helping to improve this situation. The term enclosure is poorly defined in the NEC. NEMA 1 means a flimsy general purpose box with ventilation holes. It is a violation of the NEC to block ventilation, and 6 inches of space for airflow may be required by the installation instructions, which are enforceable via UL listing and the NEC approved equipment. NEMA 3R is rain tight, listed for outdoor installation, but not limited to outdoor installation. NEMA 4X is dust tight, corrosion proof, and usually, but not always, heavy duty. NEMA 12 is dust tight, and usually, but not always, heavy duty. It's important to specify heavy duty, not just the NEMA rating. NEMA 7 is explosion proof, but this terminology should not be used in specifying equipment. Rather, say Class 1, Division 2, Group D explosion proof, and we will discuss flavors of this later, but Class 1, Division 2, Group D is the most common. The term multi-wire branch circuit is further developed in the 2008 edition, mostly because of new requirements, which will be covered later. The example which causes the most trouble is two receptacle circuits fed from opposite sides of a 240-120 circuit. The two hot conductors and a single neutral constitute a multi-wire branch circuit. The new requirement is for the two-pole circuit breaker to feed the circuit. Similarly, three receptacles fed from three phases of 208-120. Three hot conductors and a single neutral constitute a multi-wire circuit and require a three-pole circuit breaker. This shows up most often in residential living rooms and daisy-chained commercial receptacles, but it also applies to lighting circuits. That 208-120 lighting circuits or 277-480 lighting circuits. Multi-outlet assembly is a power strip or power pole. In schools, it's common to buy rows of movable computer tables with power strips. The power strips may be shipped in individual desks or field attached to a row of desks. Even with the 2008 changes, this is not quite legal. Flexible wiring must not be used for permanent installations. This is Section 400.8, and must not be attached to building surfaces. Use of power strips and data racks is legal if they're fed by flexible metal conduit or something similar. There are special permissions for flexible cables in properly protected data rooms listed in Section 645.5. The code handbook gives an example of surface-mounted raceway above a residential kitchen counter. It's common to use surface-mounted raceway above benches in shops and labs also. The old-style school computer labs have rows of computers along the walls, successfully used on permanently installed surface raceway for both power and data. Caution, spaces for 40 persons or more may be classified by the building code as places of assembly and limit surface raceway to metallic construction only. Overcurrent and overload are defined in Article 100. The concept is clear, more amps flowing than the rating of the conductor or device. But interpretations and implementations muddy the concept considerably. For conductors, the NEC rating is not the manufacturer's rating. NEC conductor ratings are listed in Table 310.16. be very careful to get the right table. Your author recommends using the column for 60-degree wire, but specify 90-degree wire. That is, get the high-temperature wire, but only use it at its 60-degree rating. Be warned, there are derating requirements for more than 3 current-carrying conductors in a raceway, for above roofs, and in spaces above 86F. Also be warned that loads being connected for the current project can change, and nobody tells you. These are some of the reasons to use the 90-degree wire at 60-degree rating. These are not reasons not to check on conductor count, location of runs, or load ratings. The definition of qualified person was mentioned earlier in the discussion of arc flash. It's been revised in the 2008 National Electric Code. This is part of the NFPA effort to regulate construction and maintenance. Now notice, we started out trying to avoid fires. Now we're regulating construction and maintenance. Maybe that's the same thing, but it looks like an extension to me. If this change on a qualified person is not particularly significant as regards design for electrical construction, you and me, that is. It's rather another stick to use on the contractor or owner if anyone gets hurt for any reason during construction or later maintenance. The change in the 2008 National Electric Code requires explicit safety training. Experience alone is not adequate. Training implies documented training, both as code compliance and in preparation for future lawsuits. Separately derived system is terminology to emphasize grounding in a special class of equipment. Everything has to be grounded except natural gas pipes and some very rare special cases. When you create a new voltage source using a transformer, inverter, or generator, the source circuit must be grounded. It's usually a good idea to bond the new source to the incoming ground from its supply, but the code requires a building ground and sometimes a water ground. There is controversy on how you ground a diesel or gasoline generator because they're often portable. They are separately derived sources. Please read the fine print if you're under pressure to save money. But the clean and safe way is to drive a ground rod at the source and bond the new ground to everything around you, just like an electric service. Sidebar discussion. How do you ground a motor generator or a power distribution unit transformer for computers on the 8th floor of an office building, especially when the computer rep demands a driven ground rod? The answer, just like any other separately derived source, bond to building steel and everything else around. Run a big copper conductor to the basement and drive the ground rod for the man. The National Electric Code prevails, except in very, very rare cases after a lot of arguing and sign-off by the City Plans Review Department. Computer technicians are becoming more sophisticated, but some, especially legacy experts, want to float their new systems ungrounded. This is not permitted. Service conductors have definition and extended discussion later. The key concepts are as follows. Protect the service conductors. There's no real overload or short circuit protection from the utility. The utility has rapid response maintenance available and considers continuity of operation during overload preferable to equipment protection. Install a service entrance rated switch where the service entrance conductors enter the building. Some jurisdictions require the switch outside. Remember that you can run the service conductors under a concrete slab and they first enter the building at the central electric room. This saves long feeders and voltage drop problems. Do a real good job of grounding the service entrance. Driving 3 ground rods before the slab is poured is not a problem. Try real hard to get a Cadweld or UL-rated ground clamp on some rebar and bring it up to the service entrance. Provide a ground strip for telephone, data, satellite, and such at the utility meter. Provide main protection for the facility. This means ground fault protection if the switch can carry over 1,000 amps. Some tricky people have tried to get 950-amp circuit breakers to avoid this, but it doesn't work. 950-amp trip means the switch rating is 1,000 amps and it needs a ground fault protection. Comply with labeling requirements for multiple services, ground locations, and building wire color codes. Let me say that again because it's just totally ignored. I never ever see this installed. comply with labeling requirements for multiple services, ground locations, and building wire color codes. Code says you got to have a little placard that says where each of the service entrances is, and you must locate this placard at each of the service entrances. So if you got 120 coming in the northeast corner, you've got a sign that says we got 480 coming in the southwest corner. And in the southwest corner, we've got one identifying both the 120 and the 480. There's a joke that only a single service is required to a facility. Any sizable facility ends up with another service for the garage building or pump house or for the auditorium addition. Multiple services minimize voltage drop, have some billing advantages, and provide no problems whatsoever as long as labeling requirements are followed. Each service must have a list of all services, voltages, and locations. Short circuit rating has a definition that gives no indication of the problems and interpretations in following sections. Be warned that the code requires that worst case bolded fault short circuit current must be used for sizing and specifications. Unfortunately, this magnitude is a rare occurrence, and real world faults may not be handled well by using this sizing criterion. Specifically, there is a mid-range for short-circuit currents where the protective devices aren't sure if it's an overload and they don't clear. Such an arc fault can keep blowing copper droplets at the electrician for a long time. When I say a long time, in overload protection, 10 seconds is a long time. 100 seconds is a long time. Rapid response is less than one cycle. When we say a current limiting fuse, that means it never reaches the peak of the sine wave. Surge protective device has a revised definition in the 2008 National Electric Code, which obsoletes all previous units. SPD, surge protective devices, must be labeled type 1, type 2, type 3, or type 4. Older units without this labeling are non-compliant. Type 1 is for line side of the service entrance. Type 2 is for load side of the service entrance or panels. Type 3 and 4 are at the load. Nominal voltage is defined in the NEC as multiples of 120/240 and 208/120. This works well domestically and clears up a lot of earlier problems on system and distribution ratings. Unfortunately, special care is required for international project. Mexico claims 127 volt receptacle voltage, which has been measured at hotels with very bright incandescent lights. Industrial occupancies install standard 480/120/208 transformers and use the voltage taps to deliver 127/220 for receptacles. U.S. and most international industrial equipment will be supplied by 480/120 control transformers. The local 127 is within NEMA limits for controls, but a utility which is running hot will apply overvoltage to U.S. components. Utilities with regulation problems run hot at the transformer so they can accept more voltage drop at the far end. Now, in a different example, a job for South Korea was designed for 440-volt distribution, meaning that NEMA starters are being overloaded at their maximum U.S. horsepower ratings. Transformer sizing required different multipliers for load horsepower than used on 480 volts. Again, 440 volts is the low end of the NEMA limits. However, voltage drop will be more severe when you start out with the low end of the range. The engineer should state the application voltage in each of his purchase specifications and not count on front-end project definitions, and there will be awkward phone calls. It's time to go into Article 110, Requirements for Electrical Installations, and this is the core of what inspectors do, seeing if it's been installed according to Article 110. I'm going to take a break, get a drink of water. I suggest you take a break. You can come back to it immediately if that appeals to you, or I'll meet with you again tomorrow and we'll talk about Article 110.